Hey there, this is Kevin from the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, and I have something new for you. We're launching a brand new podcast, and this is it. It's the DIY Musician Stories Podcast, hosted by Monty Carty. This will have a similar indie vibe that you're used to from the DIY Musician Podcast, but it will solely focus on musicians and their stories, stories of struggle and success. And it'll dive into topics more about their music and artistic expression. In order to introduce you to this new podcast, we're putting the first few episodes down the DIY Musician Podcast feed. So that's why you're hearing this right now. So if you're liking this new podcast and what you're hearing, you'll want to be sure to subscribe to this directly. All you have to do is search DIY Musician Stories wherever you listen to podcasts and hit that subscribe button. Don't worry, the DIY Musician Podcast that you've known and loved for years is still going strong, but now you have two podcasts to listen to and enjoy. With all that said, here's the DIY Musician Stories Podcast, hosted by Monty Carty.
Hi there, it's Monty. I am so excited to share this episode. Singer-songwriter Amethyst Kia is just such a gem. She talks so openly about overcoming trauma and pain, and how music was her emotional vehicle to process deep feelings. She speaks on the transition of music in her life from an escape into a career, on being a part of the Grammy-nominated project, Our Native Daughters, and how she's been leaning into live streams during this time. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Here's my conversation with Amethyst. Well, first of all, how are you during this... Wow. I mean, unprecedented time and just how are you? Where are you?
Well, so I'm at home. I live in Johnson City, Tennessee. So I've basically just mostly been staying in Johnson City for the past 3 months. And I'll say that from an emotional standpoint, it's been very challenging because, you know, as a person that, you know, as a gigging musician, and I think this is also something that I think a lot of people can relate to that are really into their career doing it full time. And in a lot of ways, you start to you unconsciously or consciously, your whole identity is based around what you do for your job. I mean, I usually thought that was something that was just for people that worked 9 to 5s, but I didn't realize that I was actually also under that spell, because once the gigs started to disappear and I had to cancel flights and I had to cancel rental cars, and I'm just like, okay, well, my entire life for the past, particularly the past 4 years, has been booking things, planning things, going on like the whole nine, and now ordering more merchandise. And now it's just like, okay, now what? Right. So I had like this, you know, a couple of weeks where I had this existential crisis of like, who am I, you know? And I started talking to other people about that, and everybody was sort of, you know, across career fields, like, you know, where do we, you know, where do we go from here? And then obviously, like, path forward, a lot of, you know, the festivals that I was going to play or the venues I was going to play moved toward doing live streams, pre-recorded performance videos. And so I've been able to kind of lean into that. And then I have this part-time job at Target back where I live now, where I've been working there forever. And they've been really supportive and great about me needing to leave to go on the road. And so basically I worked at Target, you know, when things were a little slow. So yeah, so my entire like lifestyle has changed. And so it's just been a very,
well, that'll really freak you. Yeah.
Yeah.
it's interesting. It's such a big thing really to unravel this, how I think we so often tie our identities to what we do. And it's a question, actually, I like to usually ask at the beginning of my podcast, and I was going to ask you this too, because I think, of course, there's so much more to a person beyond like what they are doing professionally. But so often they get mixed together or it kind of blends into one. And we forget that, you know, it's so easy to get wrapped up in that. And I'd love to ask, you know,
and maybe this is a good way to place to ask you is, you know, professionally you are a musician and a songwriter, and we'll talk all about those parts of your life in this interview. But I would also love to hear, like, how would you describe yourself beyond what you do?
Wow. Well, you know, this is something that I've had a lot of time to think about that for the past 2 or 3 months.
Yeah.
And I would say that I'm a person that I've faced a couple of traumas in my past, and the past 12 or 15 years, I have been repressing and ignoring and putting up walls and keeping a certain amount of distance from people from an emotional perspective. And I, for the past 4 years, have been trying to heal from that and really seeing the kind of person that I can become. Because what happens with trauma is your brain finds ways to cope with it. And if you cope with it in a way that's not healthy, then you become the trauma, you become how you respond to the trauma. And that's not a true depiction of who a person is. But sometimes if we're living in our traumatic past, then like how we act around other people, whether it be staying withdrawn or whether it be lashing out or whatever that case may be,
yes,
we're perceiving that person that is who they are. And anyway, that's a whole, I mean, that's, you know, that's,
no, I love this topic.
I'm trying not to go too far off on a tangent. That's one thing about myself is I can go on a tangent and then have to try to reel myself back in. So that's
too,
one thing
too,
about me. Yeah. Okay, great. So
yeah,
you understand.
I get it.
Yeah. But yeah, so, I mean, it's, so for me, this past several months has been like, you know, this piecing together of like, what are my interests? What do I, because for me, music started, I mean, it started as a hobby when I was much younger, but it was a very important tool to cope with the anxiety and things that I was dealing with. And so music has been very intertwined with a kind of therapy, a very strong escape for me. And so the transition from it being my escape to, hey, everybody, come see me perform at blah, blah, blah. Like to go from that to that, you know, obviously over, you know, this 10 year period that I've been a performing musician, it's been, again, I was in it and I was doing these things and I was making these changes, but I wasn't really taking time to step back and reflect on like how I was feeling about all of these things, you know. And, you know, meanwhile, while I'm trying to be a performer, I'm also still hesitant and still have these walls up to protect myself. And I didn't realize that I was doing that when it was happening. I mean, this is only in hindsight after 4 years of going to my wonderful therapist and talking about this stuff, that I'm able to even articulate what was going on with me, you know. And despite these psychological things I was dealing with, I was still able to like start the career and that I've been able to start. And, you know, and I think one really important thing that I really think helped me along the way, well, I know helped me along the way, was my father, because before I realized what it was, he saw the hesitancy within me, the fear in me to be able to step out and do something on my own, even though he was aware that I had, he saw the talent and the potential, and he stuck by me this whole way and has always pushed me and has been very supportive. And that's another thing I was very fortunate to have that. So even during these times where I was in and out of, you know, being confused, being anxious, I had someone behind me being like, you can do this, like, take a deep breath, you can do this. And so now for the first time in, you know, I guess for a bigger part of my adult life, you know, I went from, you know, being really consumed with music. Obviously, like having that heavy concentration in, you know, with school, they didn't have a personal social life at all. It was all about studying music, the performance part that laid a very strong foundation from which I'm standing on now. Mm-hmm. But now I'm also seeing that, like, how I can continue to grow and heal from the things that I was trying to, I guess, protect myself from. Like, yeah. It's okay to have feelings. It's okay to, like, to have a feeling, even a negative emotion, and to sit with it and recognize, hey, this is how I feel, as opposed to just trying to ignore it, because then you just become numb to everything.
Yes.
Like, it's like, now I'm like, wow, I actually get excited about things again. Like, I'm able to, I've kind of reconnected with, my love. I love to cook. I love to play video games. I love to read for fun, there's just lots of, these different aspects of myself now that I'm able to really kind of tap into. So I guess to answer your original question, like, who am I, outside of being a musician, it's like, I'm starting to figure it out, I guess, is the short answer.
Yeah. And that's the lifelong, process. And I'm so happy you just brought all that up, because I really wanted to touch on this with you, because I was listening to your song Wild Turkey, which I love so, so much.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. It made me start crying in a good way, and it kind of, from what I understand, the song is about grief and sort of numbing your pain. And, and you brought that up just now. And I'm really fascinated by this, because I think a lot of us do this. And, something I heard, Mary Gaucher, who I was speaking with recently, said this thing that her emotional reality is in songs. And I think she was sort of speaking about this too, about, like, kind of being able to, like, unleash the emotions, like, while listening to a song or writing a song. And I've know that with myself. And it sounds like you're also have gone through this, where, like, I sometimes can just, like, based on past trauma too, like, numb my feelings, but then I'll hear a song or I'll write something and it, like, suddenly I'm just, like, sobbing and it all comes out, and that's the feeling, and the emotion is released. And I'm so curious to hear about your experience with that. And, like, it sounds like music really helped you to help you find that access, that point and that part of yourself to really be able to begin to heal. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. So, when it really came to kind of using music as this emotional vehicle to, like, deal with feelings, I noticed that especially, particularly, again, like, in my mid to late teens and into my early 20s, like, these very emotional songs that I would really tap into that, like, matched exactly how I was feeling, and then going on to either performing those songs or writing songs that also were in that same vein, what I had a difficult time dealing with was outside of that world, that emotional world where I felt, where I didn't feel alone. Once I left that world and would be in, the reality where real human beings and things are, I would have a hard time being able to transition into, like, meaningful human interaction with people. So that's where, like, having that, kind of 10-foot pole away from my heart and my mind from everybody, just so I wouldn't be disappointed if someone abandoned me or left or did, whatever, which is why, the performance aspect, and then, getting into, like, really interacting with humans, essentially.
Yes.
And, like, really, it took me a while to really fully grasp and understand that the other people listening to my music are the same. How do I put this? Other people listening to my music, it was the same thing as when I listened to Tori Amos's music, or Radiohead's music, or Nina Simone's music. Like, it's the same thing. And then I finally, like, it finally all clicked, you know, that like, we're all in this together. I've not been alone this whole time. I just didn't know how to reach out and make the connection, you know, in real life that I was making in my own little music world.
Yes.
So when it comes to writing Wild Turkey, you know, the last time that I had written something about my mother was it was for her funeral, actually. And that song, I wrote a song specifically about how I was feeling, and I sang it there. And then that's pretty much the last time I've ever had ever really sung anything about my mother. I didn't really even talk about my mom or, you know, how she died or anything for a really long time. I just never felt comfortable talking about it. So when it came time for Wild Turkey, I was getting to this point, and this is after maybe like a year or two into therapy, where I'm like, okay, a lot of my behaviors and a lot of my anxiety and a lot of my fears stem from not allowing myself to grieve for my mother. And so, so Wild Turkey was the first step of, like, you know, it was actually the first time that I had ever told the band that I play with that lives here in Johnson City. It's the first time I'd ever told them about, you know, what happened, and like, you know, that I'm trying to write the song. It took me 2 years to write the song because nothing seemed right. Like, even in that, it was a real struggle. But once I finally found something that made sense to me, and I finally sang it, and then, you know, it was just like, okay, this is it. Like, I've, you know, when I say this is it, like, obviously this is, when someone leaves your life that was so important to you, like, it's never something that, you know, obviously that never just goes away, and you never, you know, totally like close that part off. You just find ways to cope with it. But writing that song was that step of like, I'm here to, you know, I'm here and able to recognize that this happened to me, and it was okay to not be okay. And this is, you know, this was me telling my 17-year-old self, like, hey, like, don't close yourself off. Like, you know, it's okay to have these feelings, and just giving myself permission to grieve, essentially. And once I was able to write that song, it just, things started to become a little bit easier, I guess, you know, as far as being able to really start to deal with things in a healthier way, as opposed to just withdrawing or running away to try harder. And I still struggle with it. I still have instances where if I get really, you know, stressed out or anxious, I have a tendency to kind of just kind of disappear, you know, depending on what it is. But it's, I'm getting better at, you know, asking for help or saying, hey, I'm really having a hard time right now. Like, you know, like, I'm just getting better at that. And most people, I realize, like, that they understand, like, they get it, you know? And again, it's that, it was always that fear of, like, you know, because my, you know, my mother committed suicide. So during that moment, I was like, well, if my mom, you know, if my mom really loved me, she would have stayed. So why would I expect anybody else to stay, you know? And that was something that I didn't understand what suicide was, what depression was. I didn't, none of that made sense to me when I was that young. And as I got older, I started to realize, well, you know, there's so much more to it than that, you know? And
Oh yeah. And it's especially at that age, I mean, I'm not a therapist, but I spent a lot of time in therapy, and you know, I know that that's like, I mean, that's where you really form all these like beliefs about yourself, and it's so easy to turn something like that inward, and you know, and thank you for sharing that. And I heard something that you said at another podcast interview about getting about sort of, I think it was that you were saying you felt sort of disconnected from where you were living. Potentially that you were finding solace maybe in books and music. And I love that topic too, because I think a lot of us, you know, when we are feeling really lonely, there's this kind of really healing aspect of both books and music where we can sort of just find our home in there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to just ask, kind of open that up and ask, like, yeah, when you were feeling very lonely, maybe at that kind of younger age, or even now too, but like, how did books and music really like play that role in your life to really help you feel more, less alone?
Well, the stories, the books and the music that I was listening to, usually the content, the whatever character was in the song was usually talking about loss or feeling alienated or feeling invisible or, you know, struggling to, you know, stand up for themselves or totally are able to overcome adversity. Those are usually the kind of themes that I tend to draw to. So, you know, like I mentioned earlier, like a lot of Tori Amos' stuff really resonated. Mm. And then later on, like, you know, people like, obviously, like Nina Simone would be mm-hmm. another person that really resonated. And then like Radiohead, like, you know, a bunch of, you know, weird nerdy kids going to high school together, like, coming together and like playing music and finding their way, like those kinds of stories. And usually, obviously, like the artists themselves all come from a particular background, regardless of where they grew up or what their socioeconomic status was. There's always this element of like, I felt weird and alienated. Mm. So I created this world, you know,
yes.
And they were able to do something that was special and meaningful and able to actually like be able to in some ways make a living at doing this said thing. So those are really, you know, inspiring. I mean, I guess in a lot of ways, like I had no idea like what I essentially wanted to be, if I wanted to be a musician or if I wanted to be a writer, if I wanted to be, I don't know. Those kinds of stories kind of gave me hope that, like, you know, maybe someday I'll, you know, find my place. I just didn't know when or how that was going to happen. But yeah, that's what the, you know, the books and music, for me, it was this, you know, this sense of like, you know, if I'm so uncertain of my world day to day, but like when I'm in this world of music and movies and different things like that, like I felt like I had like at least some element of my control in my life, you know?
Yeah, right, so, right.
Yeah.
And also it's like, you can sort of feel like you found your people, even if they don't know you, you know,
that's exactly, that's kind of like it was like, I had this little group of people that like, you know, I guess live in my brain and like, I guess in a way. So that was kind of like, well, if I don't have any, if I can't really find my place now, obviously it's not to say that I didn't have, you know, people that I hung out with in high school and things like that. And I certainly did have some really cool moments and some really memorable moments and good times with people. But at the end of the day, there was always this like sense of like underlying, like melancholy kind of thing.
Yes.
And it's just interesting because now, you know, and particularly with this album that I'm finishing up this year and then we'll be looking to release it sometime in 2021. You know, the name of the album is called Wary and Strange. And that is Wary and Strange. That phrase like popped into my head like when I was in high school. So it's hung around for the past like 15 years, just kind of waiting for a place. And over the past 5 or 6 years, the songs that I've written have all dealt with, you know, overcoming, you know, trauma and pain, Wild Turkey being one of the songs. But it all kind of deals with like heartache in some way. And now as I've moved on into where I am presently now, I can say for the first time in a really long time that like that, I feel like I'm coming on the other side of like the healing has truly really has really started. And so now some of the newer songs that I've been writing or been inspired to write are like actually things with outside of myself. I mean, I'm still, you know, obviously I'm still present in the songs, but now I'm, you know, I'm not compelled to write super sad songs anymore because I'm not super sad anymore, I guess.
Yes.
But so now I'm able to sort of like look out into the world and like, you know, make observations and comment on things that are happening. And to really kind of, I mean, the stuff is still like, you know, the subject matter is still, I would say, you know, for the most part, pretty like heavy, but it's now coming from a different, there's going to be a lot more like emotional, I guess a little more on emotional dynamic as far as what the songs are going to be about. And it's kind of weird because for the long time I was like the sad girl that was really sad all the time. And like, I kind of, it was kind of like my identity in a way, you know?
Yeah.
And now that that's shifting, it's like, okay, like it's, yeah, I don't know. It's just a different, it's just a different thing that I'm getting used to, but I definitely don't hate it. So, you know, I'll
take
it.
Enjoy it. Emotion, you know, and like in different points in our life. And of course, when you do a lot of work to try to heal a lot of those like root wounds, there's a lot, there's some lightness that comes from that inevitably, hopefully.
Yeah, exactly.
But I would say too, that like, I love the title of that album. I think that, I when I really think about it, like, I don't know a single artist personally who is happy all the time. Like all the artists I know have to have this depth of emotion,
right,
you know, in
exactly.
order to do what they do.
Yeah.
So yeah. So when you were speaking, I really like was thinking about that. Like, you know, and it's good to have that range.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. If it's either all one way or all the other way, then like if you're like, I know there's this, I kind of gone in this rabbit hole of like on YouTube recently about toxic positivity and how selling the idea of like hustling and being happy all the time and like trying to be positive all the time, and that it's actually just another form of repressing, like how I was sad all the time and I was repressing, like, and I was making myself numb. Like, you can also go the other way where you want to be positive all the time and then you neglect like certain parts of you're neglecting your emotional depth, and then it's going to come out in other like weird, crazy ways that you didn't expect. So
totally. Absolutely. Oh my gosh. Yeah. There's a balance, I think, you know, of like learning how to just like you had said earlier, sit with your feelings and feel your feelings. But also there's this like, I something I've really worked on myself is like not to wallow so much, you know, like where it's like, I want to feel what I feel, but also like sober up a bit to it, to my emotions, and like not go down this you know, unproductive road.
Right,
of like,
exactly.
Oh, like this is happening again, poor me, you know, like.
Right, exactly, yeah.
That's what I'm working on. So I think, you know, it's good to it's good to feel the feelings, but also like make room for joy too, you know,
right,
and to
exactly.
like, yeah, and lightness. I really want to talk about our native daughters. Gosh, Allie is a friend of mine, and
she's
my heart.
Amazing.
She's amazing.
Yeah.
And so are you. I can totally see. She's always talking about you all and just how special you all are to her. And I can see why, you know, and I would love to. So Our Native Daughters is this incredible project that you all have put together. And well, instead of me trying to talk about it, why don't you tell me or tell us about that and what it's meant to you?
Yeah. So Songs of Our Native Daughters is a project that Rhiannon Giddens is the brainchild of the concept for this project, and she reached out to she was looking for black women that knew how to play banjo. That was her. So she didn't. So her pool was fairly small. So it didn't take for very long for her to find the people. Essentially, myself and Allison Russell and Layla McCullough, we all agreed to be part of this amazing project, and it was inspired by Rhiannon's visit to the National African American History and Culture Museum in Washington, D.C. And she was in the first floor, in the very first exhibit on the first floor, and it was about the transatlantic slave trade. And she was so moved obviously, you know, the pandemic's happening right now, but if any, like you or anybody watching or listening to this, like if you ever get the chance to go to that museum,
yeah,
I absolutely recommend it. They've done such an amazing job. I cried a couple of times. Like it was just incredible what they did with it. So,
wow.
But yeah, so she was just very moved by what she saw, and she decided that she wanted to create music that shared the stories of enslaved people and what that system did to both the people that traded the enslaved people and the enslaved people themselves, and to really highlight what that meant to be enslaved, the things that happened, and how that set a precedent for race relations over the past, you know, 300 years, all the way up until now, of course. So,
yes.
So we looked at artifacts in the museum. We looked at different sheet music, photographs, and just to allow for inspiration. And then, we got together in Lafayette, Louisiana at Dirk Powell's studio. Dirk Powell co-produced the record with Rhiannon and also recorded it and played several instruments on it as well. We basically wrote and recorded for about 3 weeks. And it was such a powerful experience, because usually, and like all four of us, we have we're basically what would be called the not like the other black people essentially, because there's been this kind of like, I guess, authenticity of blackness that's been sort of culturally like created. So some of the charges would be you know, you're trying to talk white, or you're listening to white people music. Like, we've heard it all, you know?
Yeah.
And then, you know, in white circles, you know, we're seen as like, you know, not like the other black people, which is kind of a, I'm not saying everybody, obviously, but you know, that's a thing as well. And, people getting us confused with other black people at shows. And like one time me and my dad, we were at a festival in Florida, and a couple came up to us and thought that we were War and Treaty.
Oh my gosh.
And it's like, are you kidding me?
Wow.
Right now, like, wow. But the thing is like, we were able to sit down and share all of these experiences and to be able to have that.
Yeah.
Like a lot of people, I mean, lots of people get to sit down and just, they get it. They don't have to like explain it. They don't have to educate or teach anybody. It's just, I got you. I know exactly how that feels. That is something that is very special that that I had not quite experienced in the same way. I obviously have been able to relate to people about various different kinds of things. But when it comes to like really that core issue of like being a Black person and being in a space where your interests, people don't really understand the history of those interests and where they come from and why they exist. And so you're questioned because your interests are essentially racialized. Yeah. Like that, you know, to have that kind of removed completely throughout this entire process was so amazing.
Wow.
And so that was a very special thing that, that I am so glad that Rhiannon reached out to us. I'm so glad that, you know, I know them and had a chance to work with them, and we continue to stay in touch to this day. And we're wanting to continue on and like, do some more music together. So obviously like I cannot even remotely give an idea as to, you know, when any of that will happen, but, because there's still issues to be discussed.
Yes.
As we all know.
Clearly, yes.
we're in touch and we're going to keep creating beautiful music together. So,
I'm so glad to hear that. And I was just having like chills when you were speaking, because like what you're describing is like still, you know, feeling like other again, you know, and like that feeling of like not belonging again, and to feel like you can have your sisterhood, you know, of like these people that really get it on such a deep level.
Exactly.
I can only imagine what that's like.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing all that. And
And
I'm just so grateful that you all got together.
Oh, thank you.
I wanted to ask one last thing. I don't think I ever asked Allie this, but did you guys all know each other at all before you got together, or was it all or not?
So interestingly enough, so I have been a fan of the Carolina Chocolate Drops since like, I guess like 2011, 2012 or something like that. And I actually had like met them a couple of times, kind of like in passing at the festival. But when I really got to start to get to know Rhiannon and work with her is when, like back in 2017, excuse me, early 2016, her manager or her booking agent, who is now also my booking agent, got really lucky with that, asked me if I wanted to open for her because she was looking for openers and she likes to give opportunities to musicians of color in the Americana realm to like open for her. So that's where I initially like really started to get to know her and like be on the road. And then with Allie, I actually met Birds of Chicago a couple years before I went on tour with Rhiannon, and we played a show at in Greenwood, South Carolina. And they had their daughter, Ida. I don't think she was old enough to walk yet. So I met them then. And then, and Layla I had never met before because I think she joined the Chocolate Drops later. And I don't think I saw them live when she was playing with them. I never got a chance to meet her before this. But obviously, like, loved her in the band, and I've loved her original material as well. So this was like the first time I guess we'd all ended up like being in the same room together. And then I'd learned that Allie had known Rhiannon for like almost 10 years. And so
Wow. That's so cool. And then you just formed a super group. I love it.
The super group thing. I was like, oh my God, I guess we are super. I wasn't thinking of it that way, but you know,
It's incredible. Well, switching gears a little bit, I wanted to ask you if you can think of a situation where something in your life as a musician didn't work out the way that you had hoped, but then something better ended up coming through?
So I guess back in 2015, I got asked to audition for The Voice, and it was a by appointment audition, which is great because then you're not, you know, waiting for like 5 or 6 hours and then having people have you run around for B-roll. Like, and that's a whole other thing that kind of irks me about some of these award shows, shows. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah.
I don't want that tangent. But right. So by appointment is the way to go. So I remember that during this time, I was going through a bit of a hard time because I had decided to like go to grad school for liberal studies. And then I also like had added a whole lot of commitments to my plate. And I was miserable because I said yes to too many things and mm-hmm. I didn't feel like I was really giving my all in any of them. So by the time I went to this audition, I'd gained some weight because I just wasn't eating well. I wasn't getting exercise. So like my clothes weren't really fitting right. So I was self-conscious about that. And then I booked this really cheap hotel that looked like it was in a good location. And then when we got there that night, there were like prostitutes that were like walking like around the hotel, like wow. talking to people. Like they tried to talk to us. Then the guy, the person that took us to our room took us to a room next door where the door was open and there were like 10 people in there and the music was really loud and like it was just a really like not a good vibe at all. And so we decided to get the heck out of there, but then none of the hotels around were empty, so we had to drive hour away to stay somewhere else. So I didn't go to bed until like 3 a.m. I had to wake up at like 4 hours later. Oh. So my clothes don't fit right and I'm tired. And then I go to this audition and I sing Jolene, which is kind of like around here, like where I live, like people, if I don't sing that song before I leave the stage, like people are like, why didn't you sing Jolene? Yeah. So anyway, so I do that and I feel like crap and I'm singing it. And like, I notice like the casting producers, they're kind of bobbing back and forth and I'm like, okay, they're into it. And then I get to the second song and like, I'm getting prepared to do my second song. And they're like, well, I don't think this will work out. I think if you want to come the next time you come back, make sure that you work on your stage presence and your energy. And I was absolutely crushed. I was so crushed. But what ended up happening, like about a month later, is I ended up doing my very first tour in the UK, where I traveled for like 2 weeks playing in like mostly in Scotland and then on some of the Scottish islands and then a few shows in England. And it was one of the most incredible experiences of my entire life. So it was kind of, so when that happened and I saw the response I was getting from people, like, you know, on the other side of the Atlantic, I was like, you know, I think I'm going to be okay.
I do is I kind of ruminate. I'm like, oh, like I could have done this better. I could have like, if like, oh, if only I had like slept those extra 4 hours and yeah, I had right. the right hotel, all this stuff. And, but it's almost like a little like nudge. This sounds very woo woo, but like a little nudge from the universe being like, nope, right. that's not your thing, you know, cause something better right. is waiting for you.
Right. Yeah.
I love that. I love that. And also I have a friend that was on The Voice. Like she got like pretty far and it just wasn't a good experience for her. So yeah, I'm sure you've heard that from other people.
Well, yeah. You know, after the fact, I started to kind of really dig into like the details of things. And it's kind of like, it becomes your whole life, whatever yeah. you're doing in your own career, your own for your own music, because I got an email like almost every year after that, like about setting up an appointment. But I started to realize like, I like what I'm doing and developing right now. So yeah. I threw what I'm doing to the side and like learn a bunch of top 40 stuff, which I don't really like. It was totally in a totally different like what realm and style of performing that it was just not really on my radar. And when I started to really see like what actually is involved with the taping and how things are edited and like what happens yeah. if you do win, like yeah. the fact that you're basically signing everything kind of away yep. to everybody else. And, you know, I really value like transparency, and I value people that respect where I am and want to help shape and guide me to go further within my realm of what I'm doing. And I started to realize, you know, this isn't really going to be for me anyway. So in a way, I'm kind of glad. I mean, obviously the experience was terrible, but I'm kind of, like you said, the nudge from the universe. I found out later on, I'm like, you know, this actually is not really yeah. what I want, you know? So, and totally. I mean, and maybe it does work for some people, you know, I can't really, you know, I don't ever want to say that, you know, it totally sucks and no one should do it, right. but you know, there's a certain level of, autonomy, I think, that you lose
yes.
that is
yes.
very
yes.
important to me. I very much value that. So yeah.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because I think that's an important thing to really think about as you go into a career in music. Like, what is the most important thing to you? And I think if you really do want value autonomy and being able to like have flexibility, you know, that going the route of The Voice or, you know, that kind of thing is not the right path for that, you know? Uh-huh. And yeah. It seems to me like you really built a wonderful team around you. I love you. I've been, you know, communicating with your manager and just like love him.
He's yeah.
He obviously really, really values you.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's like priceless to have that, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's what's really kind of helped me, I guess, along the way of like, you know, picking people that I feel like our values, I can tell that our values match up and make sense. Is when I was studying. I got my undergraduate degree in bluegrass, old time and country music, and a huge portion of that was studying, you know, Appalachian culture and yeah. Southern culture and Southern music, and the beginning of the recording industry was a big part of that history. And it literally was, you know, record executives, people, you know, essentially investing money into records. Like the idea of like, hey, you want to listen to your favorite singer? Well, now you at any time you want, well, now you can. And so mm-hmm. the record industry, you know, was essentially begun. And literally we're looking at record executives. Not all of them were musicians. A lot of them yeah. weren't. And what they saw were dollar signs, and they yeah. would pay you if you got paid the smallest minute amount that they could. They took it. A lot of them took advantage of musicians that had no idea about business, who had no idea about what was happening.
Yep.
You know, and so that has been a longstanding history. And in the recording industry is, you know, I guess more or less the men in suits deciding how music is going to be consumed, how they're going to pay the musicians, how much money they're going to stuff in their pockets. And so really in the past several, you know, past few decades, like this advent of like booking agents and managers and record labels that value transparency is such an important, innovative part of the music industry that is so important. And when I started reading about that history, and then I started making connections of like, you know, in more like contemporary times, and these things still happen now, like in a lot of, you know, in popular music, there's still plenty of, you know, agents and managers who they look at their bottom line. I mean, you look at what happened with Amy Winehouse. They put this woman, literally, they put her out on stage. She could barely function. She had no business. She needed help. And instead of helping her, they pushed her and pushed her until, you know, until she died, essentially. And so like that, to me, you know, looking at all of that history from Amy Winehouse all the way back to, you know, the very first commercial recording where an artist got paid $50 and that's all they ever saw from their record that maybe sold, that possibly sold thousands of copies, if not millions. I thought to myself immediately, I'm like, I don't ever want to have a team around me that doesn't, that is not transparent, that doesn't care about my well-being, and doesn't believe in the music that I'm doing. Like that is absolutely, and I don't care if that, if that meant that I was gonna, you know, run things myself for a while, which is what I did. And it was very difficult because going from the creative mind to the business mind is no easy feat at all. But if it was going to take me being on my own for a while, you know, for the longest time, it's been, you know, me and my dad on the road, you know, and like that's, it's been a two person team for almost 10 years. So, you know, the fact that, you know, now I've been able to, you know, connect with these really incredible, people that believe in transparency and will call BS when they see it, you know, and will be honest with me. Like that is, anyway, I could go on and on about that.
I'm hanging on your every word because I feel this so deeply too. I'm on the other side, you know, I have an artist manager too. And I feel that way with the artist. I manage Misty Boyce, who's a singer songwriter. She plays in Lord Huron and Sarah Bareilles' band, but then she has a solo career.
Cool.
Yeah. She's amazing. And I everything you're saying, it's like, I feel that way about her. I feel so, so passionate about her music. And I just love her as a person. And like our relationship is a friendship too. Like, you know, it's, we're always talking about like real life too. And I think, and I just think that's so important to wait for the right people. It's just like in a romantic relationship, right? Like you want to wait, you don't want to settle for somebody like just because to have somebody. When you're picking your team, and you hit on something that I think is going to be so valuable for people to hear, because I actually think as an artist, like I think people are often so eager to just have a team behind them, but there's such value in doing it on your own for a bit to really see also like what you want in a manager, what you want in a label, like, and you can't really figure that out without having to like do it on your own for a bit. You know,
right? Exactly.
It's important, and I would really emphasize that, like how the importance of just waiting for the right fit.
Absolutely,
Nothing worse than working with people that like, you just feel like don't get you and don't like aren't like in, you know, enhancing.
Oh, yeah, it's exactly. Like, you know, well, it's really interesting because it's like if you can like just imagine if you're like 17, 18 years old, and like some big time manager like offers you everything, offers you a house to stay in, offers you, just rolls out the red carpet and offers you everything you can possibly imagine. This is what happened with, there's this really incredible documentary that Lance Bass of NSYNC, he started a production company, put out a documentary about Lou Pearlman, who managed like all of the big like boy bands of like the, of the mid to late 90s, like NSYNC and Backstreet Boys, LFO, all those bands. And
yeah,
they recounted, some of the members of NSYNC recounted the experience where for like 3 years, they worked, they rehearsed 18 hours a day. They sold out arenas. They were given a house to stay in on Lou Pearlman's massive estate. He had this very charismatic, like persuasive persona. And like these kids, they were like 17, 18 years old. They worked and rehearsed and played and traveled everywhere and did all this work for 3 years. And one night he finally says, all right, now comes your paycheck. And everybody's excited. And he invites mm-hmm. them to this fancy dinner. All five members of the band and their parents were at this dinner. Lou Pearlman, he paid for everything. And then he placed checks before each and every band member. They opened up the check. And for 3 years of work, each band member only got $10,000 for
wow.
3 years of work. And So ooh. Anyway, the NSYNC, they did sue him, and on a technicality, they did win. But so there was, I guess, if you want to call it a happy ending, but
yeah, to just very, ending, yeah,
right, yeah, just ending is a better way to put it. But just, you know, how many other musicians have like faced something like that? You know, and if you're some people that are so young. And then if you have parents that like don't understand anything about the yep. industry, and if someone's charismatic and comes across like they care, yep. like I used to wonder how are these people get involved with this stuff? This doesn't make any sense, obviously. And then I started to realize, oh, this is can totally happen to somebody,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah, exactly. When you just don't know better, you know, you don't know.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I think that's so valuable for people to hear, you know?
Yeah. It's an amazing documentary. It's like it's on YouTube. It's on the YouTube, subscriptions or YouTube premium, I should say. So I think that's the only place that's really airing right okay. now. Someone might've ripped it and put it on free YouTube. I don't know, but yeah. I highly recommend it. It's a really, incredible documentary. There's wow. a whole bunch of other, this man was a despicable human being. There's all kinds of crazy stuff on that documentary that he did, but it's really, really well done, really compelling and really, heart wrenching and very much, many lessons to be learned from watching, and I highly recommend.
Wow! Oh, I'm actually I'm about to start teaching an artist management class, so this will be a good one to watch.
Oh yeah, they're gonna lose their minds when they see yeah. it. It's crazy.
Wow! Okay, so I could talk to you all day long, but I just have one more question for now.
Sure.
I hope we get to meet in person one day.
Oh, that would be amazing. I'd love that.
Yeah. Let's make it happen. Okay, so I love this question. It's just like fun to hear the answers. So who are some lesser known artists or artists that are under the radar that you really love right now?
Oh, interesting. You know, I'm going to be honest. So for the past like couple of weeks for the past 3 weeks, there's been two things that have been happening with me. One is since the beginning of June, for about 2 weeks, I listened to Lady Gaga's Chromatica like nonstop for like 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Not exactly under the radar. but
nonetheless, it has, you know, it's influence.
Right. But yeah. And it's like, and what was inspiring about listening to that record is that, you know, she put out these, you know, this, you know, these two pretty heavy music projects. You know, she put out Joanne, which is very like just lyrically and musically just like heavier, like less dance, more like storytelling. And then obviously A Star Is Born, which, you know, it obviously the movie, this is like the fourth time the movie's been remade, but there's a lot of original songs on there. And the movie, like the way it was, you know, it was just a great movie with really great music. But again, not very light, you know?
No. Yeah.
And,
no.
And this record, like, I remember when I first, because my girlfriend absolutely loves Lady Gaga. So, but like, so when this album came out and the very first single, Stupid Love, came out, I was like in a sort of a weird headspace at the moment. And I was like, started immediately criticizing, well, you know, this isn't as like lyrically compelling as her last album, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, Amethyst, can you just shut up and let me enjoy the song? Like, why are you? And it took me aback, and I'm like, you know, there's something to be said for that. Like, Jessica keeps me kind of on my toes. She kind of helps me to remember to, like, you know, that there's the lighter side of things too. That everything doesn't have to be like so serious and so analytical.
Yeah.
And so now that the Riffle record came out, and I'm now starting to really like focus on healing and like allowing myself to really enjoy things that I enjoy. I've always enjoyed like dance music, you know, of all genres, but also like, you know, like 90s club dance music is like, I've always thought that was fun. So I've just allowed myself to just enjoy the heck out of the record. And then I've also been like revisiting stuff that I used to listen to when I was in high school, just to kind of see if it still holds water with me now.
So
I've been listening to, I didn't realize how much new metal I listened to in high school until I really started going back and digging in. And I'm like, you know, I listened to a lot of Evanescence. I listened to like Linkin Park. I listened to like Static X, which is a little more like on like the little further into the metal end. And then like, I've been revisiting, there's like symphonic, like Scandinavian metal that I listened to, like Nightwish. So anyway, I've just been kind of digging into things that I haven't listened to in a while. And then I've been obsessed with this Lady Gaga record. So that's kind of like,
that's awesome.
That's kind of where I am right now.
No, I love that answer. It's also like, it's cool how you can revisit. I'm really fascinated by this, like revisiting songs and also books like that meant something to you many, many moons ago, like when you were in a different place in your life, and then like seeing something different in them, you know, it's really, it's a cool thing.
And then on top of that, like I've also been kind of connecting, like I've been sort of kind of binging on some of these, there's like a channel that I watch on YouTube that the guy, he's like an alternative, like kind of punk music guy. And he kind of makes these videos about different genres of alternative music and kind of like the history of them and why they died out or whatever. And it's, so what it's led me to kind of listen to, like I started listening to Rage Against the Machine, and they literally are like they're like, as far as I can tell, one of the first bands to really like combine like hip hop and like hardcore and metal and make it sound not campy. And like also delivering this like really like very like in your face, you know, message. And it blew up. And like that whole history was really fascinating. And then listening to these new metal bands and listening to the grooves and like the rhythms that they use and how much of it was influenced by Rage Against the Machine's like influence. And so I've been kind of, I don't know, going down my own little like music history thing, like making all these connections for that. I don't know. That's just always how my brain works. But that's been my musical experience lately for the past like month.
I really like the way your brain works. I gotta say,
that's the way my brain works.
I'm like, I really enjoyed this conversation.
That's awesome. Thank you.
Let's continue it again sometime.
Oh, that was great. Yeah, thanks so much for having me. You know, CD Baby, like since 2011, has been my ride or die. Like putting out my records and like sending me my checks every month for the digital sales. So this was really cool to be able to actually do this podcast, you know, because I've been so using CD Baby for years. So this is great.
That makes me so happy to hear. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll be in touch. And thank you again. You really lifted my day up.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Great conversation. This is the highlight of my day. So the rest of the day is going to be great. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay. We'll talk soon.
All right. Talk soon. Bye.
Bye.